What's it like when one of your friends on death row is led away to be executed?
You have a prepaid call from
William A. Aguirre,
an inmate at the California State Prison, San Quentin. This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I had to be a different complete guy, which is the guy who walked the walkways of San Quentin death row and without a gang, without a group of people around me. It was just me.
Soon after you went into to be on death row, and you didn't really understand the prison workout system so much, but then he said, we're going to do 75 sets of it. To me, that seems extreme. So I'm wondering if there's a danger of overtraining, wearing yourself out so that you're...
No, that's actually funny. That's, and it's funny. I'll tell you why. That's a good one, Matt. I'll tell you why.
Welcome to Death Row Diaries. I'm Matt Ralston.
And I'm William Aguirre.
All right, Bill, how are you doing today? We've had some bad luck with the phone system and all that. Yeah, it's been a rough week or so as far as the podcast goes, but that's okay, right?
Yeah, a lot of things are changing, and when you change prisons, and it's just a different situation. When I was on death row, if something went wrong with the phone, it usually got fixed very quickly because, well, what happens is the convict's normal reaction to things that don't go their way, especially on death row, which is a level 4, which is the highest level of prisons in the United States, and especially in California, you know, usually it's violence. It's usually violence against people, violence against whoever is a target. And when inmates or actually convicts, when they get upset because things are not going as they perceive it to go, you know, it gets fixed really quickly because staff knows these guys are going to do probably something very violent. Here, it's different. This is a level 2 prison, Corcoran. It's a level, it's what's called a program facility. And there is, that mentality doesn't exist here for the most part. When something goes wrong, like the phones don't work, you know, there's a grievance filed, you speak to staff, you ask. It's a different situation, so things don't get done as quickly as you would like, and that's what we're experiencing right now with the phones. But it kind of gives us the opportunity to really update listeners. Those who have been with us for the past couple of years know the story, but those who are new to the program, and as you and I both have recently recognize, as we're getting a lot of new followers, we kind of want to give them an update to who we are, what we do, why we're here, and where exactly I'm at.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should probably do it at the beginning of every show, but I find that annoying when I'm listening to a podcast because it's like I already know what's going on, and I think it's pretty obvious, but nonetheless, it's good to have an update. Before we do that, I do want to remind everyone to follow us on Patreon at Death Row Diaries, where you will get bonus episodes. Also, check us out on Instagram and Facebook. If you have a question for Bill, you can send it in there, and we will get to it at some point. So, the name of the show, obviously, is Death Row Diaries. And when we started recording, you were on death row. And now you're not. There was a process where you were moved, and changing the name of the show doesn't make any sense. You're still in prison, obviously, but why don't we walk everyone through briefly kind of what happened there?
Yeah, well, for those who don't know, I was convicted for murder in 1983. I spent 40 years in prison, specifically on death row for that crime that I committed as a 18-year-old boy. During that time, I, you know, kind of there was an aha moment when a teenager realizes through maturity, brain development, just the process of maturity, that life is not about violence. Life is not about just doing whatever you feels right at the moment. And those are some of the issues with impulse control with youth. And I had that issue. It was exacerbated with, of course, the use of anabolic steroids, but this is not about an excuse. This is about the process. And, you know, I came to that realization, and I began to rehabilitate myself by educating myself. And then as time went on, I became an award-winning artist. I wrote the book Escape Artist, Memoir of a Visionary Artist on Death Row. And really, the trajectory of my incarceration began by helping other prisoners first embrace rehabilitation for those who actually wanted it. And there are a few youth offenders who were very young when they committed their crimes. And I began to lecture on the yards about rehabilitation, accepting responsibility. And that kind of led to universities, MBA programs. I began to lecture on ethics, professional conduct, rehabilitation, prison reform. And that really kind of led me in a roundabout way to where I thought that educating the public about the prison life, prison culture, as well as the specific area of serial killers really does more benefit than harm. And what I mean by that is that, of course, the public is a willing consumer of this for a number of reasons. Sometimes for entertainment value, sometimes because really there are predators out there that can harm you. And that's really where I come in. I wanted to educate the public so they're not readily victimized. And as time went on, I began looking for really a platform. And a friend of ours introduced me to Matt. Matt and I talked for several weeks about what we could possibly give the public. And we kind of came up with, you know, the whole thing of this platform, which is a podcast where I would come in from death row where I had been convicted and sentenced to death. And we basically started the program then. And of course, it's evolved to what it is today. I think the public already knows, or they should know, that along the way, I became an expert at serial killers. I've spent 40 years living with them, not reading books or imagining sitting in a visiting room with a guy who is not going to tell you anything because he's telling you over a Coke and a hamburger, which is what a lot of these so-called profilers and experts, that's where they deem that their expertise comes from. So I know that Matt and I have chuckled over that, because what is it we talk about, Matt, that if I read a few books about heart surgery, would you allow me to perform heart surgery on you? And the obvious answer is no.
Right. So when you were convicted, you were the youngest person sentenced to death in California at that time. So under normal circumstances, 99.9% of the time, someone under the circumstances of that crime would have been out of prison a long time ago. They certainly wouldn't have been on death row surrounded by serial killers. So you had the disadvantage, but for the purposes of what we're talking about, the advantage of being a normal guy surrounded by these just crazy, I mean, killers, serial killers and killers of all different kinds. That's a pretty, correct. That's a unique circumstance.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, it's just a unique circumstance. That's kind of what's led you to what you're working on now.
And that is correct. If you look at the circumstances of the case itself, you know, homicide, killing, murder is always heinous. But when the California voters in 1978 voted for the Briggs Initiative, which was Proposition 7, and they enacted the death penalty, it was for the worst of the worst. And that would be rapists, serial killers, child molesters, people who have their entire career harmed people, murdered people. It's just the worst of the worst. There was no coming back, no rehabilitation from that. Unfortunately, counties, you know, Los Angeles, Orange, San Diego, Riverside County, well, it became a political deal where people that didn't have or were unfortunate to have the finances that O.J. Simpson had were getting convicted for crimes that obviously bad and heinous, but there were kids. There were 18, 19-year-old kids that committed these crimes. And we know today that, of course, some of those kids can be rehabilitated. And the voters Will was the worst. Not a guy who committed a crime when he's a teenager, his first offense, and a jury, because of political reasons, because a DA went after him, sent him to death row. So, that being said, I did find myself on death row, but the truth is that the circumstances that my life, or the trajectory that my life took, is the only way I could have come to become the profiler and serial killer expert that I am today. And that is because I was surrounded by them. At a very early age, I was able to pick up on the cues and the different things that they did. And of course, along the line, I decided to actually study, research, compile an archive that's never been amassed before, in order to break the riddle, solve the cases, and basically help victims' families grasp or have a bit of finalization, because there's a lot of killers on death row that killed more than the people they were convicted of, and those families of those other victims never got finalization. So I took it upon myself to really try and give those victims' families exactly that.
Yeah, and I don't know the word for it, because you weren't undercover. In a way you were, but you were actually in prison, but you were pretending to be buddies with these guys. Sometimes you were having to listen to their stories and pretend you were entertained or that you identified with them. Who are some of the guys that you spent the most time talking to and that you trying to study and extract information from?
Well, they were and are the most notorious of serial killers the world's ever seen. Serial killers like Randy Kraft, known as the Scorecard Killer. William Bonning, known as the Freeway Killer. Lawrence Bittaker, the Toolbox Killer. Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. And the list goes on and on. I mean, I could say Rodney Alcala, the Dating Game Killer. There's just been so many famous killers that I got very close to. And you're right, it was very difficult to listen to these guys' stories because they enjoyed it. And let me just say this to those who have not heard me in the past talk about this. There is no rehabilitation for serial perpetrators. There is no rehabilitation from a guy who is a serial killer who kills for the rush, for the adrenaline rush of killing. So serial killers cannot be rehabilitated. So to listen to them speak, really, sometimes I wanted to strangle these guys, because they talked about how they harmed a child, how they raped, tortured, and mutilated women. So it was very difficult for a person who didn't have that particular mindset. But all the while, I was undercover. I was fooling them into believing that I was like-minded. So I listened with great enthusiasm. The whole time I was compiling this archive of traits, reasoning, and at the same time, as you know, for the past 11 years, I was writing a book about a particular serial killer who had, I guess, if you want to call it, bring me into the fraternity of serial killers, because I lied. I fooled into believing that I, in fact, was also a serial killer who had not been caught. Yes, I was on death row for a different crime, but they all associate it with being put in prison for...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
But the truth is that I was guilty of so much more. And that was the point that I fooled them into believing, and they gave me information they never would have given anybody else, and I wrote an entire book on it, on a particular serial killer. Let me call you back, Nat.
Thank you for using...
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah, so different tactics that you had. Obviously, just listening to them ramble and pretending you were interested in these stories, not from the point of view that you were, but from the point of view of a creep, pressing for details. I'm assuming you don't want to press too hard, but also there were other things, right? I mean, some of these guys had pictures or maps. Even you could say, what is this? Sometimes a lot of these guys are feeble, and you know, they would want to be friends with you because you're a, you know, a tough guy. You're in good shape, and all these different ways that you played on them a little bit, right?
Yeah, it's a perfect atmosphere to get close to someone because of the yard setup. And in prison, there's a pecking order. It's a hierarchy of killers, if you will, or of convicts. And I use that to my advantage, to control the situation, to isolate the particular serial killer in order to get closer. Now, this didn't take 6 months or a year. This took 40 years. And I want the audience to actually understand the amount of time I spent with them. It wasn't the, you know, there's a lot of crime writers and a lot of people that are experts that spent a few months speaking to a serial killer, visiting him or talking on the phone or writing him. I actually spent decades with them. And, you know, that's what distinguished my expertise, is that I was able to go back. For example, a guy who writes about true crime or serial killers or is an expert at this, you know, would speak to a serial killer, write him a letter, and the killer writes him, hey, I went to the store on this date, I did that. Well, he's taking him on face value. The advantage that I have that others, experts, don't have or could never have is that I could return to that same killer a decade later and, using my notes, ask him the same question and see if there was consistency in the answer. If he said the same exact story with all the details in place 10 years later, that gives me a bit of, that I lean towards, this guy's telling you the absolute truth. Because how many different stories has he talked about, or how many different people has he spoken to in a decade? And I come back and ask him the same exact question, and he gives me the same exact answer. Consistency is a big deal, and that's something that I've been able to do that no other expert has ever even imagined doing.
Yeah, because you have to weed stuff out, because most of these guys, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but a high percentage of them are liars. They like to boast about things they did because in their mind that makes them, you know, more, it makes them stand out, or that helps their ego out. And so, yeah, I mean, you didn't just take anything at face value. You heard a lot of bullshit too, right?
Well, of course, and then that's part of the things that I do really well, is that I'm a student of human behavior as well. Again, I didn't read it in a book. I didn't learn it in a classroom. I actually learned it where my life depended on it. If a psychologist or psychiatrist makes a mistake, no harm. No one dies that day. Where I come into play is walking to the yard to read that yard, read the gangs, read the killers. If I make a mistake, the consequences is I might die that day. Because on those type of yards, when you have a feeling, you see something, something's out of place, your instincts tell you a certain thing. And most times, in most people, your brain overrides it. I learned to trust my instincts. So I read people and read circumstances probably better than anybody else. And in prison, that's a given. You have to be able to read the yard, read the people in it, because your life ultimately depends on it.
So I don't know how much you want to give away, but and you're not the typical convict, but let's say someone who has a good reputation is within the prison, you know, is not someone who's in prison for killing children and things like this, and you get wind of some information that you think is credible. What do you do at that point?
Well, at that point, there's really nothing you can do. You listen and see how gratuitous. Even anybody in prison can be a liar. So it's a matter of actually just documenting. Because remember, it's not like the victim is in a cage somewhere and this guy is going to kill him and we're racing against time. In my circumstance, the crime's already happened. My interest is to be able to educate the public on what's going on. And if there are victims' families that their child disappeared or their wife disappeared and no one ever found out what happened to them and they're left with that big question mark, my job is to bring finalization, to tell them actually this is the guy who did it and this is where the person is. And that is what led to writing the book, which now has a publisher. It, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, it will be published January the 7th, 2025. Prior to this, I had said it's going to be published before then, and some things happened that, well, actually made the case more interesting. More cases, cold cases, were solved by the information that I got, and a television series is now going to come out about the book. The book is called Through the Lens of a Monster, A Serial Killer on Death Row, A Unsolved Murder List, and An Inmate's or Prisoner's Deadly Play for Redemption. And it will be out, the television series, as I mentioned, coming out about it. And that was actually the ultimate goal, is to bring those families finalization and really to attach the correct amount of murders to these serial killers, because a lot of these serial killers on death row or regular prisons have a number of cases that have been unsolved because they're unwilling to give that information. I was able to ascertain that information with conversations with them, and it's been deemed credible. And, well, we hope that the victims' families in this circumstance get the finalization that they've long awaited and were due for decades.
So how are you feeling now that you've been moved to this lower-level prison? Before, for 40 years, as you said, you were surrounded by these serial killers, these guys that drank people's blood and still had photos of the victims, and not just them. I mean, there were other mass murderers and things like that, but now you're in the company of smaller time criminals, gangbangers, you know, guys like that, right? So, because I imagine it affected you having to extract this information, listen to these stories in detail. I can't even imagine, even when we do a podcast and we have to talk about, oh, then he, you know, did this to the kid, and then he, it even affects me sometimes, but certainly I'm not exposed to it on anything like that level.
Yeah, well, obviously it's not the easiest job in the world, and it is difficult. It makes you a bit jaded, a little calloused to listen to them. But ultimately, it's not about me. This is about helping the public, you know, educate them better, the public, and finding justice or finalization from a victim's family, for a victim's family. So it really doesn't matter how it affected me. Has it done some horrible things to my mind? I would say no, because I was looking upon this as a researcher, as a person who is studying them. I wasn't actually involved in their killing spree, so I don't know if it affected. It's hard to listen to, of course, but I don't think it affected me in a negative way. My circumstances now are much better. And you're right, I'm not surrounded by 768 murderers who have killed children, etc. This is a level 2 program facility. It's a soft yard, what I call a yard for guys who are trying to go home. There are rehabilitative programs here. I've actually formed a new program called Youth Corps, which is a mentorship program to help kids that are, you know, about to make that mistake in their life, which could land them in prison or in juvenile hall or YA. And I am facilitating a program in order to help them not make these mistakes. This yard where I'm at, which is Corcoran 4B Level 2, has a lot of good programs. The staff here is really dedicated to helping people. I am dedicated to helping people. I also teach and facilitated NA and AA class, both in Spanish and in English. So this is a very good place. There's not that much tension here. There's less serious things going on. So honestly, I feel pretty good. It's more a college campus than it is a prison. And I don't know if the audience understands that, because of where I was, that was a prison. This, although still a prison, feels almost like a college campus, at least to me.
Yeah, because you were locked down, most of the day, and you could go out to the yard, but even that was pretty dangerous. And now you can pretty much walk around all day, right?
Yeah, and on death row, I was double escort. I mean, two officers were with me at all times. I was chained at all times. Anytime I left my cell, even going to the shower, I was chained and cuffed. So there was no freedom. There was no escaping the reality of where you were. The yards were more than just pretty dangerous. People were murdered out there. They were stabbed. They were raped. They were extorted. They were beat. They were assaulted every day. Here, that doesn't happen because, as I mentioned, this is a program facility, and most of the guys here are rehabilitated guys who will be released very shortly. A lot of them have already gone home, and it is more about what the new model for California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation is about, which is actually to bring, when guys commit an offense, they come to prison, they're educated, they are rehabilitated, and then when they get out, they can serve society in a positive way. Not so much on death row, because they're supposed to be the worst, and no one gives a damn. That is the difference, and something I appreciate. Being here makes my life a lot better. I wish someday to go home, but for now, there's a lot of good I can do here, and I will do good here.
Yeah, so obviously step in the right direction. And you have a newsletter where you fill everyone in on what's going on, what you've been working on. You're getting more done than most people who aren't in prison. There's a TV project. There's the book that you've been referring to. And there's art exhibits. But these are all on your newsletter, right?
Yeah, I put out a newsletter called The Insider, the True Crime Insider. So the insiders are the people who subscribe to it. And for the last couple of months, there's been kind of a glitch. Not so much a glitch, but my publisher has been involved in editing and getting this new book ready to go. And it's been, we haven't had a newsletter out. But next week, the newsletter comes. It's going to be out again. There's a lot of stuff. I'm writing stories about serial killers. So look, sign up for the newsletter. You can go to my website, williamnoguera.com. Sign up for it. It's free, and you'll get that. And of course, Escape Artist is the book I have out now. If you want to know about what happens on death row, please pick it up. It surely will be an eye-opener for you. I have a new book coming out, of course, which is Through a Lens of a Monster, and a television series on a major network that'll be coming out in 2025. And I hope that everybody subscribes to me, check it out, and really picks up on what I'm doing. As always, I always appreciate every one of you guys, and we'll be here for years to come to give you guys the inside scoop on what happens on death row and about serial killers and true crime.
Yeah, and we'll be back next week with another case that we're going to analyze. So until then, I've been Matt Ralston.
And I'm William Nogueira. Be safe. Be aware of your surroundings. Your life could depend on it. We'll see you next time.